This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
As you've mentioned, this is a project which I'm working on right now. So you're going to see some very preliminary research, but I hope you'll find it interesting. And of course, I welcome all questions and remarks. This is all to improve it. As I know, this could be controversial in parts, but I think you will nevertheless find it quite interesting. So as an introduction, as most of us or all of us know, Helios, a second generation Titan of the Sun, was an immortal heavenly charioteer. Together with his sisters, Eos and Selene, Helios traversed the sky, being arguably one of the first visible embodiments of the passing time. As a deity, Helios oversaw the cycles of day and night, and thus by extension cycles of mortal growth and decay. Uniting with a goddess, Okeanid Perseis, or Destroyer, as you can see on your handouts in the family tree, Helios sired, depending on on an account, two, three, or four children, daughters Circe and Pasiphae, known as powerful witches, and Aietes and Perseus, kings. In this paper, I will focus on three family members, namely Circe, Aietes, and his daughter Medea. Appearing in one of the densest and thorniest passages of Theogony, Circe, Aietes, and Medea remain somewhat of an ontological enigma. Descended from Helios and the Achaeanid Perseus, they belong neither with Zeus's relations nor with mortals. The subsequent text section in Theogony catalogues Circe and Medea as goddesses who coupled with mortal men, with Aietes' godhood implied, but not exactly confirmed. In contrast, the Odyssey and the Argonautica de-emphasize and question their divinity, reimagining Circe and Aietes as powerful witch and an arrogant warrior king, respectively. In this paper, I argue that despite their human bearing, the Homeric Circe and Apollonian Aietes and Medea belong to a special class of gods, solitary deities who settle on earth and adopt mortal ways, or in Greek, ktonioi theoi audentes, acting as supernatural foils to marauding Olympian-backed heroes. Ever young, yet possibly vulnerable to death from wounds, descendants of Helios employ gender-dependent strategies to deal with their peculiar type of immortality, alternatively embracing isolation on Aiaia or communal life in Colchis, powers of herbalist witchcraft or bronze-wrought automata. As a Colchian king, Aietes cannot freely express his masculine divinity and must emphasize his heroic masculinity and mortality instead. But his female relatives transcend such limitations. Apollonius' Medea rejects her father and embraces familiar powers of witchcraft, whereas the Homeric Circe enjoys a fragile form of immortality in her secluded domain. As you can see regarding the structure of this paper, in the first section I briefly consider how the Theogony presents the divinity of Aietes, Circe and Medea, thus setting a standard against which their other representations will be measured. Consequently, in the following sections I explore how these deities of the Theogony are reimagined as literary characters that interact with mortals, and thus somewhat partake of their mortality. Fearing Odysseus' sword, Circe in the Odyssey nonetheless retains a particular form of immortality. In contrast, paradigms of masculine heroic behavior adopted by Aietes of the Argonautica largely preclude him from demonstrating his inherent divinity. Aietes' daughter Medea defies her father and abandons him, which enables her to break the heroic paradigm and embrace her inherent immortality. In the concluding section of this paper, I enumerate and analyze a set of features shared by Aietes, Circe, and Medea. Building on previous research by Jenny Strauss-Clay and Michael Nagler, I juxtapose these characters with nymphs described in the Apollonian Argonautica, arguing that they may be best described as ktonioi theoi audentes, solitary deities who settle on earth and adopt mortal ways. A class of divine beings very much unlike Olympian gods. To go on, Theogony contains four passages which discuss the genealogy of Aietes, Circe, and Medea. The first passage, which is number one on your handouts, functions merely as a background. It recounts the union of Titans Theia and Hyperion and enumerates their brilliant children, Helios, Eos, and Selene. Progeny of Titans and Zeus's first cousins, first generation Hyperionides indubitably classify as immortals, with Eos mentioned as a goddess who has frequently coupled with mortal men. The second passage, which is of course number two on your handouts, closes the heterogeneous penultimate part of the poem, where Hesiod first enumerates the wives of Zeus and their descendants, which is lines 886 to 929, and then recounts other divine unions, which are lines 930 to 962. Here in seven lines, we see Helios coupling with Perseus, one of the Achaeans, and siring two children, Circe and Aietes, and then Aietes marrying Idea, an Achaeanid, and his aunt through his mother, and fathering Medea. This is arguably the most condensed passage in this part of the Theogony, as it stands out in that the descendants in the Theogony, and as the divine descendants of the in the Theogony, are mentioned here as both children and grandchildren of Helios, whereas adjacent passages separately handle the birth of Harmonia, the daughter of Aphrodite, and the birth of Harmonia's demigoddess daughter Semele. So it seems like you can split the family trees in certain places in Theogony, but first, whichever reason they did this, the poet wanted to handle this whole family together in one place. Notably, marriages of Helios and Aietes are the last unions between gods and goddesses in the Theogony. In opposition, the following ultimate part of the poem catalogues goddesses who have lain with mortal men. Both Circe and Medea resurface in two passages in the catalog, which are obviously passages 3 and 4 in your handouts. The history of Medea, which began in the previous passage, finds its fulfillment. She weds Jason and bears a mortal son, Medeus. In turn, Circe gives birth to Agrius, Latinus, and Telegonus, mortal sons who were all fathered by Odysseus. Hence, two lines of Helios' descendants dissolve into mortality and fall beyond the scope of the poem, which is, of course, to describe the birth of the gods. At first glance, Aietes and Circe's immortality appears to be quite ordinary. Two deities, Helios and Perseus, produce Aietes, a god, and Circe, a goddess. Aietes couples with Idea, an Achaeanid goddess, and sires another goddess, Medea. Circe and Medea's appearance in the catalogue of immortal or Athanatai, goddesses at the end of Theogony, directly confirms that their ontological status within the text. Both Circe and Medea enter into unions with mortals. Predictably, their feminine immortality yields to masculine mortality of their partners, with both goddesses in result bearing mortal sons. Thus, the children of Helios apparently adhere to the general principles governing the inheritance of divine immortality. However, one must know that in direct contrast to Zeus and his relatives, Helios and his family remain an independent, tightly knit clan who occupy a midway point between gods and mortals within the poem. Contrasts between other gods and Hyperionides may be many to enumerate. For instance, Zeus couples with several goddesses. Helios and Aietes are monogamous. Zeus marries into several divine families. Helios and Aietes both wed Achaeanids, with Aietes marrying his own aunt. In the Theogony, Zeus's descendants are all immortals or immortalized demigods who marry other deities and have no children. They simply stop procreating. At some point, gods descended from Zeus decided that they shouldn't have any more children. In contrast, Helios's daughter and granddaughter are immortal, but they marry mortals and keep on bringing forth mortal sons. Curiously, in the text, there is no attempt to immortalize children born out of Circe and Medea, for whichever reason. As we can say, unlike Zeus, their mothers do not reintegrate them into immortality. In sum, Hyperionides form a very close endogamous clan, apparently immortal, yet their last generation succumbing to mortality. As such, the problematic portrayal of Helios' descendants generates certain ambiguities, which will become even more pronounced in other texts. In the Theogony, Circe was very much a goddess, yet the poem covertly suggested that she has much to do with mortals. Circe of the Odyssey becomes an even more complex character as the text simultaneously accentuates and undermines her divinity. In this paper, I argue that the authorial intent in the Odyssey is to make Circe weaker and less independent so that she will assist Odysseus in his journeys and not oppose him. Consequently, she is represented as vulnerable to various threats of both physical and magical nature, among them a veiled threat of death. A non-Olympian deity, descended from a titan, Circe enjoys limited immortality that lasts as long as it is not challenged by a stronger agent. She thus remains detached from both heroes who seek undying glory and from gods who relish truly eternal lives. Granted, Circe of the Odyssey is in many aspects at least as divine as the Olympians, and she shares several of their attributes, which are described in passages from 5 to 7 on your handouts. Despite her great age, she remains ever youthful, with the text explicitly categorizing her as a fair-tressed goddess. The daughter of the sun exhibits supernatural powers very similar to those wielded by the Olympians. Similarly to Athena and Hermes, Circe wields a magic wand through which she channels her power. With assorted herbs and a tap of her wand, Circe effortlessly clouds the minds of Odysseus' crewmen and transfigures them into pigs. And just as smoothly she returns them to their previous human shapes. Magic of Circe closely mirrors feats of Athena and Hermes. As Athena makes Laertes taller than before and stronger, so Circe turns Odysseus' crew back into men, making them younger than they were before and far handsomer and taller to look upon. If Hermes can incite humans or dull their senses, then Circe with her drugs can make Odysseus' crewmen forget about Ithaca. What I believe further confirms Circe's divine qualities is her deftness at binding. The reader learns that the goddess taught Odysseus how to tie an unusual knot, which is number 8 on your passage, on your handouts. Her knot is very intricate, or poikilon, and the act itself, binding, or desmon, carries subversive and dangerous connotations of control and coercion among Greek gods. Circe excels at binding magic. She is one of those cunning goddesses of Greek myth who, when confronted, attempt to bind their opponent in order to avoid being bound themselves. However, her power is not without limits. Notably, Hermes promises that he will deliver Odysseus from danger, number 9 on your handouts. Or, strictly speaking, he will release him, you note the use of the verb leo, by means of the moly herb, from Circe's power, which, unchecked, would ensnare him like a cord. Hermes' promise of unmaking Circe's power foreshadows that no matter how strongly the text accentuates Circe's divinity, just as persistently does it hint at certain ambiguity in her in the representation of her godhood, suggesting that even if in her immortality, Circe has not reached a state of full security. At the first glimpse of Circe, Odysseus' comrade Polites wonders aloud about the weaving lady. Is she some goddess or some woman? Hetheos, Mehagene. Number 10 on your handouts. Circe's activity is typically feminine or mortal, but her bearing is anything but. Accordingly, initial attempts at classifying her fail. Polites' doubt only implicitly questions Circe's divinity. When Odysseus enters Circe's abode, her godhood is directly challenged. Before her encounter with Odysseus, Circe is an ambiguous yet clearly divine figure. We know the epithets of her as a dread goddess. She is learned in fearful drugs and destructive wiles. She is full of awesome wonder, an enigmatic and darkly potent figure. Her power nonetheless falters when Odysseus thrice overcomes her. He resists her magic. He attacks her physically and finally dominates her in the sexual union. Odysseus' intrusion into Circe's domain unravels her binding magic. Crucially, Circe, this is passage 11 on your handouts, admits that Hermes foretold Odysseus' coming, and thus she recognizes Odysseus as an Olympian-vexed hero. Circe, her magic unbound, is bound herself to Odysseus' will, like the Titan ancestors in Tartarus. From that point on, she exercises her supernatural powers only when directed by her superior, this is Odysseus. When he wishes to leave her, she must consent. Relevantly, Corinne Paki perceptively observes that, I quote, "Pictorial depictions of Odysseus pursuing Circe thus put their own twist on the power reversal between mortal and immortal. Odysseus, as you can see on the picture, is depicted as the violent, desiring male pursuing a young girl, and the goddess, deprived of her power, is shown as if she were a reluctant object of desire." End of the quote. As the Olympian authority is asserted, we see Circe part by part lose her independence and magical secrets. Now, what could she lose when she would be attacked with a sword? Martin West notes a curious Near Eastern parallel. A myth recounts how a god Nergal visits a conniving underworld goddess Ereshkigal, who plots to kill Nergal. However, Nergal has been given 14 unnatural afflictions to use as weapons against her. After experiencing Molly's power and seeing a drawn sword, even a goddess like Circe may reasonably suspect that Hermes gave Odysseus another gift. A secret dangerous enough to destroy unaging beings. Circe never faced death until assaulted by Odysseus, and she is not sure whether she is immune to it. Thus, she is modeled after both immortals and mortals. She fears being bound by other gods, but she fears physical death even more. Now, How do we classify Circe of the Odyssey, an approachable yet mysterious minor goddess who wields powerful magic yet fears death? Referring to text number 2 and 12 on your handouts, one possible approach is to know that Circe, unlike Olympian deities, is a material embodied goddess. When she shows herself to Odysseus as she is, and our guests, she is lovely but not outwardly dangerous, in contrast to true forms of the Olympians, which can destroy a mortal body and have to be shielded from ephemeral eyes. Another distinguishing feature is Circe's separateness. Ageless and immortal, Circe lives alone, not living in the divine community of Olympus, where every deity has his or her share of honor, and with an attached position in the divine hierarchy, and certain rules of conduct are observed. Living at the margins of the Greek pantheon, she does not test her divinity against other gods or mortals. She remains her own person, for better or for worse. What does such a manner of living say about the kind of immortality she enjoys and temporarily shares with Odysseus? It is neither radiant glory of the Olympian apotheosed godhood, nor poetic glory of fallen heroes. Had he stayed in Calypso and Circe's domains, Odysseus would have been bracketed. His heroic glory would have been extinguished. He would have lived a silent life with a goddess, immortal but without renown, neither god nor a dead man. Odysseus rejects the immortality that is a feminine favor. Likewise, Circe's brother Aeetes refuses to be bracketed so and embraces his masculine heroic mortality. However archaic in her secluded abode Circe appears, we must remember that Aeetes is older still. In passage 13 on your handouts, Circe recounts that only ship that ever sailed between the Planctae was Jason's Argo, thanks to Hera's helping hand. We know that there were some lost pre-Apollonian narratives on the Argonauts, and they predate the Odyssey itself, which they more probably did not influence in some manner, both narratives recounting a hero's sea voyage to the world's end and his confrontation with a descendant of Helios, one brother Aeetes, one sister Circe. It is then no mere coincidence that Circe and Aeetes, respectively inhabiting places called Aiaia and Aia, are often held to be siblings. Curiously, narratives involving the pair tend to stress their dissimilarities. As we have seen, the Odyssey and Theogony call Aeetes Circe's very own blood brother, but never explicitly a god. A baneful or evil-minded king, he appears only in passing and remains shrouded in mystery. The Hellenistic work of Apollonius Rhodius, in many aspects very different from archaic epics, nonetheless develops and sheds more light on certain aspects of Aeetes' perplexing persona. In the Apollonian Argonautica, Aeetes is a ruthless, dark-hearted ruler who never ceases to brag about his divine father Helios. His palace, which is modeled on the palace of Alcinous in the Odyssey, slightly differs from the original. Gone are flourishing orchards, gold and silver of the Odyssey, replaced by omnipresent bronze and wondrous artificial contraptions crafted by Hephaestus. Bronze connotes the brutal heroes of the past Bronze Age, and Aeetes models himself after these paragons of heroic masculinity. The protracted ekphrasis of quasi-Homeric weapons in the scene where Aeetes arms himself and the mental qualities of an Iliadic warrior he exhibits all serve to reinforce his self-imposed image. Aeetes consciously represents himself as a hero of the old, a king more opulent and cultured, in essence more Greek, than the quintessential Greek heroes, the Argonauts, who visit him. Nonetheless, this self-styling comes at a price. Due to either an authorial intent or a conscious decision on Aeetes' side, the Colchian king partially extinguishes his latent solar divinity, appearing as a self-contradictory persona of indefinite ontological status. Aeetes' attitude towards divinity might be best demonstrated through investigating from where he draws his power. The Colchian king has rejected herbal pharmaca, used traditionally by his family, his sister and his daughter. Circe, a wilderness herbalist living among the beasts, closely resembles the archetypal Potnia Theron. In contrast to her, Aeetes favors technology over nature. He replaces plants with artifacts, which are enumerated in point 14 in your handouts, like the golden fleece, the adamantine plow, and the dragon's teeth. Even Aeetes' iconic animals are products of Hephaestus' mechanical artifice. Bronze-footed and bronze-mouthed automata, endowed with artificial life, starkly contrast with real lions and wolves drugged by Circe. In sum, Aeetes apparently refuses to dabble in herbalist magic, instead deciding to rely on supernatural objects. What can we say more about these objects? Well, Aeetes' shiny accoutrements are mostly divine gifts, vessels containing powers of gods who fashioned or wore them. Hermes, for instance, made the fleece golden. Hephaestus wrote the adamantine plow and the bulls. Ares, in turn, donated the breastplate. Finally, Aeetes' father, Helios, offered him swift horses. Aeetes' use of objects received from divinities falls into the masculine heroic behavior pattern. Just as so many heroes before and after him, Aeetes establishes client relationships with selected deities, his own power being a composite of powers gifted by his divine benefactors. Unlike his sister Circe, Aeetes serves his power externally. Understandably, his over-reliance on divine aid detracts much from his personal agency. However, the text never quite lets us forget that Aeetes has a divine side to him, with the son of Helios letting a part of his buried godhood shine through during his meeting with the Argonauts. When the Argonauts first come to his kingdom and ask him, ever so kindly, to yield up the golden fleece, the king initially vents his fury, but quickly masters his passion and acquiesces to the Argonauts' demands, provided they are indeed of the race of gods and not worse than him. Recognizing this universal ontological hierarchy, Aeetes places gods and demigods above mortals. Accepting the implicit challenge of the Argonauts, he responds in kind and turns the tables on the heroes by questioning their heritage and, by extension, their excellence. Admittedly, one must say that neither his first nor his second reaction are those of a god irked by hubristic mortals. You can just imagine what would Apollo do if a band of Argonauts came and started questioning him. However, Aeetes, we must say, he underscores his human side by choosing to engage Jason in an Aristeia context instead of smiting him as Zeus or Apollo would do. But he remains firmly convinced that his divinity, no matter if partial or complete, will give him enough leverage to teach those impudent Greeks a lesson. Indeed, what follows is Aeetes' description of the wondrous deeds at the field of Ares. If Aeetes can indeed yoke the fire-breathing bulls, plow the field, and defeat the Spartans like he claims, then he possesses extraordinary strength and power almost equal to that of Olympians, just as his sister's feats closely resemble those of Athena and Hermes. Jason, without any divine blood in him, or at least none in the last two generations, has to resort to cheating. Even with only one explicitly divine parent, Aeetes still outranks Jason, who had absolutely none. Aeetes, as described in the text, thus appears to retain at least a sliver, if not more, of divinity, but it is of a primordial and yet chthonic kind, very much unlike the Olympian godhood. For instance, Mary Williams noted that descriptions of Aeetes in the Argonautica closely match those of the snake in the Grove of Ares, which is a description found in point 15 on your handouts. The sleepless, emphatically immortal serpent guarding the golden fleece sprung from Gaia, which was moistened with the blood of her lastborn, Typhon. A dreadful Chthonian monster with remarkable eyes, the Apollonian snake closely resembles both Typhon, as described in Aeschylus' Prometheus Bound, and the snake guarding the golden apples of Hesperides that was born out of Phorcys and Ceto. Williams draws striking linguistic parallels between Aeschylean descriptions of Typhon and Apollonian descriptions of Aeetes and the guardian snake, arguing that the text conceptually aligns Aeetes with the serpentine nether beings, hubristic creatures, neither fully divine nor clearly mortal, traditional enemies of the Olympian order and heroes that uphold it. Typhon spread destruction with his glaring, flame-belching eyes. And, as passage number 16 shows on your handouts, Aeetes and other descendants of Helios all have flashing golden eyes, with which they can work destructive magic, as Medea did on Thales later in the Argonautica. Aeetes may not use this stare to incinerate his enemies, as other gods may do, but his bronze automata do that in his stead. Golden bulls belch flames that would have cremated Jason had Medea not counteracted their heat. The fiery golden aura of the Hyperionides has an inherently destructive aspect, and Aeetes and his family just as often walk in the shadows as they shine with their inherited light. We have observed the deftness with which Aeetes' description shifts from underemphasizing to overemphasizing the divine aspects of his persona. A question remains: why Aeetes would ever attempt to adopt the persona of a mortal hero? Well, there is no definite answer, but one possible explanation is that he is constrained by narrative patterns of the Greek myth. Choosing to settle on Earth in his kingdom, Aeetes has essentially decided to blend into the mortal realm and efface whatever degree of divinity he inherited. This happens for a reason. No male god in Greek myth ever came among humans to rule them as their king, if they had a choice to stay on Olympus. A female divinity, in contrast, like a nymph or an Oceanid, can be given in marriage to a hero. She becomes his wife, bears his children, and reintegrates herself into the mortal life. Accordingly, such a partial reintegration occurs in cases of Circe and Medea. Both bear mortal children, and their lineages dilute into mortality, but they do remain goddesses by birth and status. In contrast, a male god never forsakes immortality for his lover or kingdom. That is not without serious ontological consequences. A god by descent, a mundane king by choice, Aeetes defies these ontological categories. As he abandons his divine status and assumes the heroic role, he has to eventually confront death in battle, that final stroke and push that conclude the masculine heroic life. The main difference between the solar siblings of Circe and Aeetes stems from their gender role. Circe remains emphasizing her femininity, which empowers her to express her divinity freely, whereas Aeetes adopts the archaic hero persona, which has to a degree preclude him from flaunting his inane divinity. And typically, Aeetes remains unwilling to directly engage Jason and thus to perform the heroic role up to its bloody end. They do not fight physically as if. The son of Helios in all probability knows that his divine kinsmen were never tested in terms of invulnerability. At a certain point, his immortality could be fatally challenged, a scenario he apparently fears as much as his sister. The heroic facade Aeetes adopts cannot completely extinguish his latent divinity. The king sires an extremely powerful daughter, or Medea, who discovers her family's herbalist legacy and becomes a capable drug expert of pharmakeutria. The niece of Circe and the daughter of Aidea, the knowing one, the knowledgeable one, Medea of Hesiod's Theogony ranks with immortal goddesses, such as Demeter and Harmonia. In contrast, Demeter of the Argonautica, at the first glance, gives the impression of an awesomely potent, yet ultimately human character who expresses a whole gamut of emotions after briefly contemplating suicide. Seeking to explain her ostensibly self-contradictory depiction in the text, Fritz Graf hypothesized that Medea, originally a full-fledged goddess, was reimagined by Apollonius as a mortal heroine. Contra Fritz Graf, I would argue that Medea of the Argonautica appears as a submissive heroine who later reveals that she is a goddess after all. We have noted that Aeetes adopted this archaic hero persona, which to a great degree precluded him from flaunting his innate divinity. By going against and separating from her father, Medea rejects this limiting behavioral pattern, embraces her divine lineage, and opens the doors to the fantastic. In her thorough analysis of Medea's character in the Ars Argonautica, Evelyn Bracke noted that Medea constantly wavers between submission and independence. It is through Hera's machinations that Medea succumbs to Eros's power and enters into the Olympian sphere of influence. Bound by Eros, she must obey Jason, just as Circe, bound by Hermes's power, must obey Odysseus. Once again, an Olympian deity binds a titanic goddess by a hero proxy. However, the aunt and the niece differ in the fundamentals of their binding. Initially a powerful yet apparently mortal character, Medea submits to Hera's Olympian power via darts of Eros. Driven by her infatuation, she performs outstanding acts of magic, gathering metaphysical momentum until she regains her will, with her first independent act, the violent undoing on Talos, foreshadowing the bloodshed which is to happen in Greece. Compelled by love, Medea exercises and owns her magical power. I argue that Medea's every magical act constitutes thus a symbolic rejection of her father and, by extension, of his quasi-mortal way of life. When Medea uses magic, it is to bind, alter, and eventually destroy items and persons linked to her father. At first, Medea's involvement in the Argonauts' affairs simply requires her to temporarily nullify Aeetes' influence. The maiden employs familial powers of herbalist witchcraft to shield her beloved Jason from the fiery breath of her father's brazen bulls. Overcoming the serpentine guardian of the Golden Fleece calls for a more forceful intervention. Putting the sleepless, immortal snake to sleep, Medea demonstrates her divine mastery over supernatural beings. To close the snake's sleepless eyes is to alter it against its nature. As Aeetes denies his godhood and adopts mortal ways, so Medea pacifies the sleepless guardian and turns her father's ploys against him. Finally, by defeating Talos at the Cretan shores, Medea destroys a mechanical contraption uncannily resembling her father's bronze automata. Aeetes decided to protect his kingdom not with his innate power, but with unreliable powers contained in objects donated by other gods. By demolishing such artifacts, Medea not only accentuates her independent divinity, but also showcases her markedly grim potential. The most telling proof of Medea's awesome power is her deft use of the Promethean herb, which is handled point 17, through which she protects Jason from the bull's fiery breath and endows him with supernatural strength. The titanic blood magic she works proves to be mightier than Hephaestus' artifice embodied in the fire-breathing bulls. Interestingly, the flame they breathe is said to resemble lightning. Could indeed Medea's drug indeed be stronger than the force of Zeus's lightning bolt? Also very important is Medea's granting Jason incredible strength and stamina. Again, Holmberg observes that, I quote, Medea's deceptive drug enables the mortal hero to defy the mortal condition by granting him the means to combat a magical foe and to transcend his mortal limits in a fantastic environment in a way that is unable to Homeric heroes, end of the quote. Medea's character, in contrast, both resembles and differs from gods endowing mortals with supernatural powers. Please note points 18 to 21 on your handouts. A Greek god can pour, which is Hawain or Katahawain, supernatural beauty and grace, Haris, onto their favorites, enhancing their attractiveness or strength. For instance, Athena rejuvenates Odysseus as he is to meet Nausicaa, with a fearful, dirty man becoming radiant with charm and beauty. Analogically, Hera makes Jason radiant with graces. As Apollo reinvigorates Hector on the battlefield, so Medea fortifies Jason before his test. But their modes of action are different. Apollo uses his own might, whereas Medea applies Jason with powers stolen from another deity. The descendant of Titans, Medea temporarily imbues a mortal man with powers of another Titan, Prometheus, who is an anomalous and disturbing deity in Zeus's regime. Medea's act accordingly takes on an ambiguous and subversive meaning. In sum, Medea's divine mode of action comprises of creatively mixing and matching inherited and obtained stores of power to achieve her end. Like Kirke, Medea has a basic measure of power which she augments and diversifies through drugs. Occasionally, she also adds powers forcibly taken from other gods, like Prometheus, or obtained as favors as from Hecate. Both her aunt's niece and her father's daughter, Medea focuses her divine powers through herbal remedies, but augments them with powers unwillingly donated by other gods. By now, Apollonian Medea's divinity has been amply demonstrated. However, does she exhibit a degree of familial divine vulnerability as her aunt and father do? In an important passage from the third book, which is point 22 on your handouts, we see Medea briefly contemplating suicide. Impelled by pangs of love, she intends to help Jason, but she dreads the deep shame the betrayal of her father will bring on her. Irresolute and perturbed, she decides to commit suicide and turns to her chest to search for poisonous herbs that she could ingest. Hera makes her think of the dreadful Hades, and the light of the sun, the symbol of her grandfather, becomes even sweeter to her. In the end, she chooses to live and abet Jason in his quest. Notably, the agents of suicide are herbal life-destroying drugs or pharmaca thymophora, Medea's favorite magical reagents. This paper suggested that Kirke and Aeetes avoid direct confrontation with Odysseus and Jason for fear the visiting heroes might have been given a baneful drug or an artifact capable of destroying an aging being like them. Divine Medea can make a sleepless snake fall asleep and a mortal man become godlike in might and splendor. Therefore, it's not impossible that her curious medicine chest might have also held a drug that could drain vulnerable deities, like Medea and her family, of their seemingly inexhaustible life force. To conclude this presentation, I would like to restate the Theogony, Odyssey, and Argonautica, which are works very different in form and content and subject matter, consistently depict Circe, Aietes, and Medea as surprisingly powerful but still quite vulnerable deities that are pitted against the heroes of against the gods of Olympus and their heroes. The Theogony tantalizingly touches upon the complex status of these solar deities. Descendants of two titans, Hyperionides maintain links to ancient pre-Olympian deities. In the proem of the Theogony, we see Helios, Selene, and Eos mentioned between august and primordial figures of Cronus, Gaia, Okeanos, and Nyx. The text never specifies whether the characters sprang from Helios, inherited his immortality, allowing the reader to rely on very subtle textual clues. Their intricate solar divinity is explored in more detail only in the Odyssey and Argonautica. Both epics record how an Olympian deity overcomes a Hyperionid deity by a mortal proxy, which is a hero, either Odysseus or Jason. Hyperionides confront and eventually have to submit to marauding heroes. To press their point, the Odyssey and Argonautica explored implicit ontological differences between the family of Hyperion and the Olympians, which is point 23 on your handouts. The Olympian gods normally exist in their resplendent, awesome divine forms, assuming outward human appearance or demas and speech, aude, only when about to interact with mortals. In contrast, Hyperionides read as deities undying and ever young, yet potentially vulnerable to death from wounds. The existence of these and similar characters in Greek myths has led some researchers to argue for the existence of an entire ontological class of semi-immortal beings. This very fuzzy ontological group encompasses monsters, minor divinities of nature, and crucially our elusive immortals of human speech and bearing, or Theoi Audentes. What do we make of this very curious turn of phrase? In her 1974 article, Professor Clay has analyzed evidence related to this turn of phrase and argued that Olympian deities typically assume human form or demas, as I've mentioned, and speech only when interacting with humans, whereas Circe and her family do not need to adopt voice on form because they essentially already function as mortals, even if endowed with special powers. In a similar vein, Michael Nagler, which is handout number 24, argued that the epithet Audentes refers to a vestigial ontological class of deities, divine intermediaries, immortal but embodied and accessible to humans. I believe that this so-called ontological class has left some distinct traces in works of Greek literature, their separateness proven by specific vocabulary associated with them. For instance, let us consider passage number 25 on your handouts. When we know that the Hesiod's Works and Days allude in passing to the Epictonioi daimones, earthly diamonds, diamonds who haunt the earth, indirectly contrasted with Epuranoi Theoi, heavenly gods, tightly connected to the earth and local landscape, these ambiguous spirits fundamentally different from resplendent and aloof Olympians. However, there are other interesting bits of evidence which surface in Apollonius' Argonautica, which made further this argument. Which is passage 26 on your handouts. During their long journey back to Greece, the Argonauts encounter Libyan nymphs, who introduce themselves as Oiopoloi Ktoniai Theai Audesai, or solitary indigenous goddesses of human speech. Embedded in the Libyan landscape, these curious maidens exist apart from other gods, never straying far from their place of birth. Their land is a limitless place at the edges of the known world, a pre-Olympian landscape, where the family of Zeus do not matter and are indeed not welcome. Proceeding further to passage number 27, the Argonauts encounter the Hesperides, guardian goddesses of the golden apples. Please note the parallel with Aietes, guardian of the golden fleece, who deplore with shrill voices the unwanted incursion of Heracles, who broke into their garden and maimed the guardian snake. Angry goddesses need to be properly appeased and respectfully summoned. Orpheus does the deed, carefully hedging his prayer to include distinct groups of gods. His first call are heavenly goddesses or Uranae, probably associated with Olympians and their entourage. Entourage. Later, he mentions underworld goddesses or Kataktoniae, and finally addresses those who are called solitary nymphs, possibly having learned this particular designation from the neighboring Libyan nymphs. Judging from the Hesperides' behavior and bearing, one might indeed argue that they loosely belong to this very expensive class of Ktoniae Theoiaudentes, although they are slightly more known than their secluded Libyan neighbors. Weaving a complex web of literary allusions, Apollonius metaphorically parallels descriptions of these secluded snake accompanying goddesses with descriptions of Aetes and his guardian snake in Colchis, implying that, despite their obvious differences, both groups of characters share fundamental similarities. Bearing all that in mind, I believe the amassed body of evidence at least implies that Hyperionides belong to a wider class of Ktoniae Theoiaudentes, ctonic, indigenous deities of human appearance and speech, beautiful but not perceptibly foreign, embodied gods at Circe, Aetes and Medea settle on Earth, assume earthly mortal bearing, and lead mortal or semi-mortal lives in their secluded lands. Almost indistinguishable from humans in stature and bearing, they are endowed with human speech and can occasionally be communicated with. Being so approachable, they are confronted by mortals. Odysseus and Jason witness no divine visitation, but they simply enter their abodes. The descendants of Helios are their clients or the disciples of stronger deities, such as Aetes and Hephaestus, Medea and Hecate, or they'll have to fall in face of their mind, like Circe and Hermes and Medea and Eros. Ageless and immortal, if left undisturbed, Hyperionides are simultaneously connected to mortality and eternal life, but express their immortality in gender-dependent ways. Thank you for your attention.